Dr. Rebecca Gordon. She's the author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. And wow, here's a bit of a topic for us to get into. It seems like a kind of a heavy day today. Rebecca, hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm intrigued. When I got this book, usually I get a lot of books, and I just, you know, most of them end up on the shelf. I phoned the publicist the next day and said, I need to have this lady on the show.
Well, really, I'm curious why.
Well, first of all, it's a cool book cover. Most books I get are from Jesus publishers that have a lot of happy, shiny stuff, you know, homeschooling mom stuff, and I just throw them away. This one has this sort of dark appeal to it, And it's a dilemma that I think is not going away, number one. It's also really changed and morphed over the last few years. You know, again, it's kind of the whole thing of your book, you know, post-9/11. It does the end justify the means? That's the summarizing statement in this whole thing. Does the end justify the means, right?
So, well, actually, that's exactly the question that I want to challenge, because I don't think that's the right question to ask about torture.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
So what you're saying at the top of this interview is that I'm wrong.
No, what I'm saying at the top of this interview is that I wrote a book because a lot of people have been led to think that that's the question about torture, but it's the
right.
wrong question.
Right.
And here's why. It's because when we think about torture in our public imagination, we imagine something like Jack Bauer on 24 has to decide whether to torture one person to save all of Los Angeles. We think of torture as an isolated individual action that's separate from everything else that goes on. And in fact, the way that torture is actually practiced in countries around the world is as an ongoing institution. It's a practice, and it's got infrastructure, both physical and intellectual. It's got rituals of initiation in which people come into the practice. It's got training, and it's got a history and an institutional history and its own internal set of values that can leak out into the whole society when a society, especially a democracy, says, we are going to accept this as the price of safety. The problem is that most of the time, torture is not really about information. And in case after case after case, people will talk about in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay, all over places where there were ongoing torture regimes. Finally, after enduring hours of torture or days or weeks, they would give up a name or they would tell, you know, say an address of or something, only to hear from the torturers, oh, we already knew. The point was to make you say it. Torture isn't really about information.
Okay, so straighten me out on this one. I think that torture is much like various green initiatives that are out there, in that everybody cares about it until a bigger issue comes along.
Okay, I think you're right about that. And I think that that's why I think it's important that we keep attention on it, even though in the war on terror, people think that once President Obama was inaugurated in our country, that the U.S. involvement in torture in the so-called war on terror stopped.
Yeah.
But the reality is, unfortunately, that that's not true, both in the war on terror and in another place which is a real site of torture in our country, unfortunately, which is in the jails and prisons
right.
of the United States.
Okay, so is there, I've got to get the foundation here in this conversation, is there such a thing as a justified war, for as far as you're concerned?
Okay, so now we're talking about just war theory. That's a different question.
No, but if you say there is such a thing, no, if you say there isn't such a thing as a justified war, then I would put you in that, oh, you're, you know, that tree-hugging, extreme pacifist, kumbaya
right.
person.
Right. And my argument about torture really doesn't have to do with whether or not there's just war. That's really a separate question, because just war theory assumes a kind of an instrumental approach, that you're going to try to bring about the greatest good for the greatest number by doing what has to be done in a situation where there's no other choice. My argument about torture is that we're not really in that position.
Yeah.
That's not really what's going on here.
How do we know? Hold on. How do we know that? Because here's my impression. They torture Buddy X with the waterboard, and they get information Y out of him, which stops thousands of people from dying.
Except it's not true.
Yeah.
Except that's not what actually happened. What actually happened is that the information, the waterboarding information you're talking about,
they
was
already...
not actually about saving people's lives. It was about finding Osama bin Laden so he could be assassinated. And in fact, they already had that information before they started waterboarding.
Well, then why would they do that then?
Very good question. And the answer is, in general, that what torture regimes do is they use torture as a means of establishing political control. And so in the case, for example, of the torture regimes that are really well known in the 20th century, so we're talking, for example, the Latin American regimes, also Greece, also the Philippines, the point is that people are tortured as a way of attacking the social bodies, the organizations that might represent a threat to the regime. And that's partly by getting people to betray their fellow people. But it's also by putting those people back out on the street and letting the world see this is what happens to you if you fall afoul of the regime. Now, in the case of the United States, it was a little different because there were two audiences. One audience was the organizations that the U.S. is fighting. And the other audience is the audience of the people of the United States. Now, we believe that our country is a country that's deeply committed to human rights. And so if we find ourselves in a situation in which our government, which is supposed to be a good government, is forced to do terrible things, what that does is it reinforces in our minds the idea that we are in unique and terrible danger. Because why else would the government do that? And so there's a wonderful theologian named William Kavanaugh who wrote a book called Torture and Eucharist. And he calls this sort of revealing and not revealing that torture is going on a striptease of power. And what he says is, and what my argument is that if we allow ourselves to say, whatever it takes to keep me safe, I will permit that because the most important thing is my personal security.
Right. I mean, we're flashing back to the...
then we become cowards.
Yeah. I mean, I go to the Jack Nicholson scene where he says, you know, we stand on the wall and do stuff that you don't even want to know about in order to keep you guys safe. You can't handle the truth kind of deal. Right.
Exactly. And here's my argument, and it's a spiritual argument, really. What that does is it creates a habit, a moral habit in us of cowardice. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, and I think you'll really understand this given how you grew up, ultimately I think it's about the inability to acknowledge mortality. Mm-hmm. That we are led to believe in some way that if we just allow these things to happen, we will never die. Our ultimate security as creatures that exist will never be threatened. And that's a lie.
Okay, I got to breathe here for a second. So,
Dr.
Rebecca Gordon, she is the author of Mainstreaming Torture. No, don't be sorry. This is exactly what I want. It's just, you know, I forget to breathe when I listen. I'm a guy. I can do one thing at a time, okay?
Right.
Author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. So, Natalie, you made a lot of noises there.
A lot of gestures.
Yes,
I'm all excited.
Yeah.
No, I think
are you gesturing? Tell me.
I am gesturing. No, because I think this is great. And I think I was really interested because I did a lot of ethics and, well,
uh-huh.
And my thesis was in ethics. But but I thought it was interesting that you've gone in the direction of virtue ethics. And I can see that. Like, if you look at torture from a utilitarian or like Kantian deontological view, it's you're going to end up with the same kinds of problems.
Whoa,
yeah,
okay, listen,
just hold on.
Can we define some terms here? Go ahead, Natalie.
But it makes sense to me that if we're looking at torture, because I think you're right, all these moral dilemmas like you see on 24, which is so funny because when I saw the cover of your book, I thought 24. Because the media shows us these dilemmas where you have to torture the one person to save millions. And so we think that that's the reality, right? Of that's how things work. And it's not. All these moral dilemmas are just made up. Torture.
Thank you.
Well, but it's true. And I think the idea that, like, for one thing, we can't trust any results that torture gives us, even if we think we have new information. And it's been shown that it's completely ineffective. So I think if that's the case, then you're going in the direction of virtue ethics to say, as you're saying, if it's a institutionalized kind of thinking, then we have to change that. And we have to sort of look at ethics from what do we want to develop in ourselves and as a culture,
rather
than just simple responses to simple kind of dilemmas. And I think that's what really interested me. Because
do you guys want to exchange cell phone numbers?
No, but it's really fascinating.
This woman is on my wavelength. This is great.
Because it's a overall criticism of our culture, right? And saying we need to go back to certain developing virtues rather than saying there are simple calculations we can make to get the right moral answer, right? Like, I think we can use these principles and we get, it pumps out the right moral answer. No, but that makes sense.
They were a formula.
And it's a formula, and we're not. We're complicated humans, and I think virtue ethics understands the complexity of humans a bit better than the other theories do. So that's why I'm all excited. That's all. I'm taking this book home too.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And there's actually a section in the book in which I explain virtue ethics and what it is and, going back to Aristotle, but also you've probably heard of Alistair McIntyre.
Yes.
Who's a contemporary virtue ethicist. And so my picture of torture as a practice, which means it's like this complicated and collaborative ongoing activity that's deeply embedded within a larger society, within a larger tradition, that's what torture is.
Yes.
And we need, now he also thinks that a practice is a good thing and that it creates virtues in us. And so what I say is, okay, well, what this is then is a false practice. It's got all of the attributes of a practice, except that what it creates in us is sort of the perversion of the four classical virtues, say.
Right.
And I think, I teach undergraduates ethics for a living.
Yeah, me
too. And so I am always fascinated by their response to these different ethicists. And I always start with Aristotle, partly because they have no sense of history. And if I don't do that, they'll tell me Aristotle was quoting from Shakespeare.
Yes! Jeez.
Poor Drew. Oh, the nerds are having
I've
a laugh.
I've lost the show, folks.
No, it's true. It's true.
Here's what Aristotle says, real quickly. He says, look, if the eye and the hand and the foot all have a purpose in the body, doesn't it make sense that human beings themselves would have some kind of purpose? And he says you can tell what something's purpose is by looking at what it's good at. And he says, okay, what are human beings good at? Well, we're good at having a soul. And a soul for him is not quite what Christians mean in the soul. It's not even the Jewish concept of nefesh. It's actually the combination of our emotional capacities and our reason together. And so what he says is, look, the purpose of life, everybody says, is happiness. But what's happiness? Well, happiness is being human as well as you possibly can over the course of a whole life. Mm-hmm. And being human means doing humanness really well, which means using your emotions and your reason as well as you can. And the way when we do that, he says we have habits that he calls virtues or excellences. And we develop the moral habits not because somebody tells us or we read a book, which is how you can learn a lot of things, but by practice. It's like fake it till you make it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
If you know you're a coward, which I am, you do crazy things like I did and put yourself in the middle of somebody else's war because that's how you're going to develop courage. You have to lean past your own midpoint to get to the middle.
Yeah.
And so this is the message, and I say to my students, it's really great you're reading this now because you're at a point in your life when you are still forming those habits. Mm-hmm. And it's really important that you think about who you want to be 30 years from now because how you act now is going to help form who you are 30 years from now.
Okay. Rebecca Gordon.
Oh, Drew, you're still here?
Wow. Rebecca Gordon, author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches to Post 9/11 United States. Okay, let's bring this down to my world for a second, please.
Absolutely.
At the risk of sounding like a reactionary redneck.
Yes.
If my daughter was kidnapped, I would have no problem torturing someone to get that information.
Okay, here's the thing. You wouldn't know how to do it.
Want to bet?
Actually, yes. Part of what torture involves is training. And in fact, back in Brazil, they literally, under U.S. direction, unfortunately, used to kidnap homeless people off the streets and bring them into classes of recruits for the police and torture them to train them in how to do it. That's one thing. But the other thing is, especially in a time-sensitive situation, torture doesn't work because the person knows all they have to do is hold out until the time is over. And so I think that what's happened is we have, because we've seen it on television and in movies, we've been led to believe that it doesn't work to do these things.
So is torture ever right?
Institutionalized state torture, which is what my book is about, the practice of torture in a government setting as an institution is never right. Individual people doing really bad things because they are in a moment of terror and horror, that's a different question. And in a sense, that's not what the book is about. I don't know. I can't tell you, would you be right or wrong to torture someone who had kidnapped your daughter? I would say that you probably don't have what they call epistemic certainty. You know, this is why they have trials, right, is to figure out whether people are guilty or innocent. You might think you had the kidnapper, and you might just have a crazy person who claimed he was the kidnapper. So that's one thing. The other thing is you might not get the answer you want. But this is not really the problem of torture. This is a problem of individuals doing bad things. This is psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And torture is not about psychopaths. Torture is not about our response to individual crazy people who in our private life have done individual crazy things. It's about setting up a whole system to do it in a routine, careful way, with record keeping, with all of the things that go with an institution. So I know you're wanting me to say, yes, you would be right to torture your kid, you know, your daughter's kidnapper. And what can I tell you? If it were me, I might do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I might get just as bad results, or I might be lucky and get good results. But that's not really what I'm talking about here. Right. And this is why I think we get confused, because those are the examples that we use when we try to understand what's really a state program.
Okay. I got to say, I put an amazing show together today, and I know this for two reasons. One, I have the wickedest headache going on right now. No, I don't.
Because he's thinking
hard. It is. I really am. Normally, you know, it's buff and fluff. That's what this show is. No, I'm kidding. You can't be the favorite of many people in the Republican Party.
I'm not. The favorite of people of many people. In fact, my partner and I were actually on the FBI's no-fly list.
Oh,
for
you're
a while.
Kidding! You are kidding!
You've just become a hero to me. This is
great.
Oh
my gosh!
This was back in 2002. So this was before the invasion, before the war in Iraq. And we were working with something that still exists. It's a website. Then it was a tabloid newspaper called War Times Tiempo de Guerras. And it was an attempt to hold the space and say in the United States, there is another alternative response to the horrors of September 11th besides war.
Right.
That there is another way of thinking about this and another way of responding. And it happened, we were going to visit my father in Boston, and we got to the airport, and the counter said, there's something wrong with my computer. Hold on a minute.
Oh, ouch.
And, you know how many times they've said that to me?
I never want to hear those words.
You really don't. So, no. But then she kept checking other people in. The computer was working fine for them, and somebody else made a phone call, and they came back to us, and they said, okay, you're both on the FBI no-fly list. We've called the police. There's a local substation here at the San Francisco airport. They're coming to get you. In the meantime, I need you to come over here and stand with me with your luggage. And so they called. The police came. They had us standing in the middle of the airport, surrounded by three armed San Francisco police. And they said, we're going to call into headquarters and find out if you're on the master list.
Oh, you don't want to be on that list.
No, you don't want to be on the master list. So we stood there for about 20 minutes. And then I began to get really thirsty. And so I said to one of them, I'm really thirsty. Would you walk with me over to that water fountain and help me get, you know, and let me get a drink of water? And they said, no, you have to stay here. And I said, okay, we're really detained. So then I said in my best innocent little girl voice, and I mean, you know, you got a picture here, two middle-class, middle-aged white ladies. Not right. as the woman behind the counter said, I don't understand this. You don't fit the profile.
Yeah, you Oh, my gosh.
And so I said to them, so suppose we are on this master list. Then what? Are you going to arrest us? And he looked at me and he said, well, we wouldn't arrest you, but we would have to detain you until the FBI can get here and they decide what to do.
Whatever that means. Oh, my gosh.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
So after about half an hour, they got a call on their radios. We were not on the master list. So eventually they let us, we had gotten to the airport early, and they, you know, they x-rayed everything, all our luggage, us, and they let us get on the airplane. And so I said to the person as we were at the gate, as we were getting on, well, is this going to happen to us every time we fly? And she said, well, I don't know, but if I were you, I'd get to the airport early. And
wow. So, you know, you should have put that in the back of the book as part of your bio. Being on a no-fly list makes me want to buy your book.
So let me tell you, what they didn't know is my partner was doing a contract for the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, at that moment. And my stepmother's brother was a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. So as soon as we got
there. Oh,
my
gosh, that's too funny.
You know, she sent drops an email to Michael. Michael calls up and says, would they talk to a reporter? And we said, oh, yeah, we would talk.
That is so funny.
You know, you are one fascinating woman, I got to say. Unbelievable. All right, listen, Dr. Rebecca Gordon is who we've been chatting with, author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. Mainstreamingtorture.org is the website you want to go to.
Right.
And
right.
Folks, what a great read. Thank you so much for your time. Rebecca.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye, Natalie.
Bye.
All right, folks. This is just a show I put together for Natalie. Whole show is for Natalie.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I really am stealing all your books, I think.
I know. That's good. This is what this is all about. Boy, she's super bad, that girl.
I got it.
The same.
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.